So good morning, everybody. My name is Juliette Rubini. I am one of the staff members here at National Quality Forum. We are going to get started this morning. We are here for the implementation acute track for the breakout sessions for today's meeting. The track leaders today are Dr. Zahid Butt and Ginny Meadows. They will be taking you through the content. I'm just sort of here to help with, you know, issues for technical things, some note-taking and such. Just some general housekeeping real quick. Everyone knows that the restrooms are out the door. Go straight till you see the sign for restrooms and you take a right. For those of you who are here in person, we do have some people on the phone. We'll be taking a brief roll call in just a moment. And when you are speaking, please use your microphone and be sure to hit the button that says speak so that the people on the phone can hear you. Any questions at this point, concerns? I'm just going to do a quick roll call. The phone lines are open, so those of you who are on the phone, please feel free to speak up with questions. If you don't feel comfortable speaking up, we are also taking questions over the chat feature, and you can use that feature to get your questions to us. Okay. So Kristen Beatson, and please pardon my pronunciation of your name. Beatson, okay, great. Dr. Zahid Butt is here. Jensen Chu, I believe he's on the phone. Okay. Melinda Costin. Linda Crabe, Brandon Crozier, Amy Crow,
here.
Great, welcome. Maureen Daly, great, welcome. Genevieve Douglas, Pamela Feeler, great. Emily Graham, no Emily, okay. Rachel Groman. Carl Gumper, he's on the web as well, no. Okay. We're not getting any. Okay. Jan Henley, great. Jan Harris, Tana Jackson, great. Alyssa Keefe, great. Evelyn Knoll, great. And Deborah Krause. Katarina Lassam, great. Jingdong Li. Ken McCormick, great. Meg McElroy.
I'm here.
Great, thank you. Ginny Meadows. Lindy Merrill, great. And Sharon Springer. Lori Thomas. Sarah Tupper?
Here.
Great. Marissa Valdez? Ferdinand Velasco? And Ann Watt? No. Okay. For those of you who are joining us via the web, are you hearing us okay and seeing everything okay?
Yes, thanks.
Great. Wonderful. So at this point, I'm just going to go through. There's a few introduction slides that were actually presented this morning by Floyd. You also have a handout in front of you that breaks out exactly what we're looking to do today here in the breakout session. You all didn't come to hear me speak, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these slides. I'd rather we get to the meat and bones of what we're doing today. Again, this slide was reviewed by Floyd this morning. The eMeasure Learning Collaborative is the public initiative that's been convened by the National Quality Forum to bring together diverse stakeholders like you all from across the quality enterprise. And what we're looking to do is promote some shared learning, to advance knowledge and best practices, and project a consistent and interactive webinar and in-person meeting agenda so that we can come together with some information to report out on. These two slides here are exactly what's on your handout, so I'll let everybody review that. You've got it in front of you. Please feel free to take notes on it. I myself, along with Faria here, will be taking minutes. We're also going to be getting some key summary points together so that when we go back to the main summary session this afternoon at 2:30, we'll have some points based on our discussions here today to bring back to the big group. And again, these are on the handout that you have in front of you. Question, sorry.
I'm a defector from one of the other groups.
Oh, great. No, we like defectors. That's fine. Okay. And your name is?
Teresa Hart.
Teresa Hart.
TRICARE.
Thank you. Do we have any other defectors? Yes.
Louise West.
Louise West. Great. Go by. I'm sorry.
Kendall.
Okay. Wonderful. Welcome. And just so you all know, the colored card that you have in your name badge is your meal ticket. Pink is salmon, yellow is chicken, and green is the veggie. So we're sort of at a wedding here in that respect. And we're lucky the lunch is actually delivered, I believe, here to this room. So when it comes, we'll just be able to grab it, come back to the table, and continue working. Okay? Any questions moving forward? Okay. We are going to be sharing some vignettes today. We have two presenters. I'm going to let Dr. Butt and Ginny introduce them. But we do have two wonderful groups here today to talk to us about their experiences. Our other objectives are to recognize current methods, challenges, and opportunities for e-measure implementation in the acute setting. We're here to identify best practices for e-measure implementation and develop recommendations to drive e-measure implementation forward. Okay. So at this point, I'm going to turn it over to our track leaders. Let me know if there's anything you need. Faria is here as well.
Okay, good morning. I'm Dr. Zahid Butt. I am one of your co-track leaders with Ginny Meadows. In my real life, I wear multiple hats. I'm a provider as well as I am a CEO of a company that does quality measurement. I'm also the chair of the HIMSS-NQF task force, and I'll let Ginny introduce later on. We're going to do a tag team format, and this is really not as much a sort of a didactic lecture format, but we selected presentations to kick off the discussion. As Farzad mentioned, we have tried to assemble the bright lights. And as he said, that there are lots of folks who say that it can't be done, and I think our goal is to say to those who say it can't be done that they should get out of the way of those who are doing it. And so hopefully the idea really is to have folks who have done it and are doing it share their experience with us. There are issues in implementation, especially as it pertains to, and you'll hear the theme over and over again, and we hear it all the time in implementation, the data capture, data flow issues, and, you know, how best to optimize it. So we hopefully will get into some conversation around that. Obviously, culture is very important, and I think Farzad touched upon that a little bit. Again, another interesting one-liner is that culture will eat strategy for lunch any day. So all strategies can literally be bogged down in culture. But we fortunately have folks representing two different spectrums in terms of size and scale of facilities who have actually successfully navigated the cultural issues, and we're all fortunate to have them here in the room and share with us how they overcame some of those cultural issues, if there were any. And to the idea is really to, at the end of the day, see what sort of best practices we can come up with the collective wisdom of the bright lights that are assembled here. I do want to recognize Debbie Krause from CMS, and she runs the acute care measurement, quality measurement at CMS. So there are lots of very important folks who are at the table, and hopefully at the end of the day we can come up with some sort of best practice recommendation as far as data capture and workflow is concerned that might help others who are going down this path, and to provide some stimulus for folks that are facing a lot of challenges at this point. So we will first have both our presenters make their presentations. They each have about 15 minutes, I believe, Juliet. We will then open up for some discussion. My guess is that it would be probably mostly around what they present and, you know, questions and so forth. That takes us to about 11:55, which is when we will be given lunch, and it's a working lunch session. And then we pick up again at 12:15 to really dive into what we can come up with a deliverable that we will have to deliver in front of the big group. So our work is cut out for us. With that, I will introduce our speakers, and we will just let both of them present one after the other, and then we will have a discussion, and Ginny will moderate that part of the discussion. I will be taking notes along with the NQF staff so that we can continue the conversation. First up will be Pam Feeler and Lindy Merrill from Phelps County Regional Hospital in Rolla, Missouri. Pam is Director of Nursing Informatics, and Lindy is the Director of Quality Measurement. They will both present their experience. They have already attested for Stage 1 meaningful use, so they have things implemented. And then we have from Texas Health Resources, Tana Jackson, who is a software analyst, and Tana's over there, and Amy Crow, who is the project consultant for the Project Management Office with the Innovative Technology Solutions Group at Texas Health Resources. So just from that title, you can tell they are a larger organization. So with that, I will turn it over to Pam and Lindy to do their presentation, and then we will have the Texas Health Resources folks make their presentation, share with us their challenges, their successes, how they navigated implementation of quality measure, e-measures, CQMs, in their institutions. So, Pam, take it away.
Thank you, Dr. Butt. We are thankful to be here today to share with you our experience and certainly to gain understanding. Thankful to the National Quality Forum for providing this collaborative. As Dr. Butt said, Lindy Merrill is with me, and she's the administrator of clinical quality measurement at our facility. We are a 242-bed facility in rural Missouri. We have attested to Stage 1 meaningful use in 2011. Our HIMSS designation is Stage 6, just to give you kind of an understanding of the foundation of where we started. And, of course, here's our mission statement. We had to bring that with us so that we could share. But we'll get into the meat of it. So just really we're going to walk through our experience and the things that we learned, the challenges that we had, and how we implemented e-measures at our facility. Initially, we performed a gap analysis with a vendor company, and we looked at where we were, certainly, and what we needed to implement to get to the goal. And just to note that we immediately noted that we had the functionality in place, and what I mean by that is we had implemented CPOE, we had implemented a data repository, closed med loop process, electronic med reconciliation. All those things were really foundational to implementing e-measures. Having said that, there was much we had not implemented, and we had certainly probably, I would say, 0% of the documentation implemented and the data capture. And to say that, then there were also processes that would need to be implemented also. So understanding the measures thoroughly, let me back up. So we established a core team, which included clinical quality measurement, IT applications, and a project manager, nursing informatics. That was really basically our core team. In addition to that, we had many ad hoc members, and we'll talk about those as we go, including a physician advisory committee. First, we really wanted to focus on understanding the measures, and especially understanding the intent of the measure also, because that's important, not to just implement the pieces, but to understand what is the intent of the measure and to maintain integrity and all of that. Some documents that we found very useful were the HITSB documents. Our HIS vendor had some best practice documents that were really helpful in terms of the functionality they provided and how we might implement those for e-measures. And then testing certification documents, which helped us understand more of the specifics. and some CMS clarification documents, which we'll talk about. Probably one of the most important pieces, I think, of the eMeasure implementation is to develop workflows for each indicator. And I think Dr. Eisenberg said this morning that the goal is to provide an unobstructive capture of data from the clinical practice, and that is huge, and that is difficult. We do not want to implement processes that decrease efficiency or provide, barriers to care. So we identified the documentation requirements for each indicator. We did ensure that we had appropriate team measures as we went along. So, for instance, if we were working on an ED indicator, we would bring in the ED director, the clinical experts to develop the measure and the workflow. We also really try to insert documentation to existing successful workflows when possible. Instead of creating new workflows, we wanted to build on the workflows that were already present. And having said that, we try to consolidate measures as much as possible, not to break those measures out, but to put them in places that could be consolidated in documentation. Part of that is standardized nomenclature, and honestly, that is new for clinicians. They haven't been exposed to that much, including SNOMED, RX norm codes, LOINC codes, and it's very important to map those in the background as much as possible. Clinicians do not need to be exposed to or have to deal with codes that aren't meaningful to them. Although they're important on the reporting side, the clinician doesn't need that. So there were instances in our HIS system where we could not do that, so we tried to minimize that as much as possible. Also, we did come upon a problem with the RX norm codes that were built into the Joint Commission value sets, just in that the clinical branded codes at times were not present in those value sets. An example of that would be Lovenox. Our facility uses Lovenox, and that RX norm code is not included in the value set. So that was, an eye-opener just to realize that there may be RX norm codes missing. So we contacted CMS, and we did get clarification from them that they did not intend to add those from stage one meaningful use, but that we could map those, medication to medication exactly in order to report those. So that was very, very helpful to know. Also, the next stage after you've built the documentation, you start capturing data, you've built the workflows, is to validate the data and to ensure that, you get every piece of the data and the indicator as you go. So we validated along the way. We validated during the build. Each point of documentation was insured. For instance, I had our supervisor call me for every stroke patient that walked into the ED initially because we were on a tight timeline for stage one attestation. So we documented along the way that we were capturing every point. Also, it's really useful. It was very important for our facility. We used a vendor to help us report the quality measures and correlate the validation of the documentation. And that helped us to drill down to even the specifics of processes or coming to individuals for education, and so we could get to the point that we could improve our compliance. Data repository accuracy was really important at our facility, and I would guess in most facilities the data repository hasn't been used to that level of accuracy before. So we never really had to monitor it so much. So when you start using the data repository for such a high level of accuracy, you need to make sure that your tables are loading properly, that the data is being collected properly. So we also implemented a software product that monitors our data repository. In terms of education for the clinicians, we did initially educate with a broad overview of the measures. These measures are new to clinicians, and they've become very familiar with core measures, and some of the measures are going to correlate closely, as stage two progresses. But just really the overview education for everybody in the organization, not even just clinicians, but everybody in the organization to understand what the measures were, looking for and what we were collecting. Then we began to focus education for each measure to the appropriate parties. For instance, we really focused on ED for their particular measures, or we focused on, for the stroke measures or the VTE measures. We tried to focus to the specific clinicians and what they needed to know. And then we used cases that fell into the denominator to focus education even more, so we could get down to the level of perhaps we put an indicator in the wrong place to capture data. Some of it that was challenging, I would say, is, you know, currently most physicians document per dictation in our facility, and that's really not conducive to e-measure reporting. And I think that's a huge hurdle nationally to bring physicians to structured documentation or to bring dictation to structured format. I don't know which way it's going to happen, but they also aren't really versed in documenting their contraindications. They document what they do pretty well, but they don't document why they don't do it. So that's a new piece that's challenging. Also, in just making sure that it's unobstructive, that the data capture is unobstructive. I'll talk about a near fail as an example. Although we're collecting the data, I see this as a near fail, an example to try to improve on. We have an order for CT. That's a general order, and we don't specifically order a CT for a specific purpose, like an abdomen or, you know, to rule out VTE. So we had to incorporate that into our general CT order. So we have a question on the order that says, is this being ordered for rule out VTE? Well, it's very cumbersome when they're using that order for other purposes. So that's when I say a near fail. I see those processes as not being greatly used to accomplish what we want. We also we need to develop clinical decision support, because as we add indicators to e-measures, physicians and clinicians in general, nurses, they are having a lot of trouble keeping up with all of the requirements for these measures. So it's important that we add clinical decision support for them to help them, to guide them on what is required. They cannot keep up with the numerous requirements. And then validation, you know, how are we going to continue to validate the e-measures and to make sure that we put in place that we are ensured that we're getting accurate data as we begin to report. Just sampling processes, that all changes for quality management. You know, they've been really careful with their sampling processes. Now that it seems as though that kind of goes away, and basically you do 100% sampling, which is better, but just an understanding of how that's going to change. And really, that's it for us. We welcome questions.
Have the Texas folks now. Do their presentation, and we'll take questions together and see if there are any commonalities and differences between the two different types of systems.
Good morning. My name is Amy Crow, and I have that long title that you mentioned. I'm the project
manager for Meaningful Use at Texas Health Resources. We're one of the largest faith-based nonprofit healthcare delivery systems in the United States. We have 13 acute care hospitals with one transitional care hospital, four magnet hospitals, over 3,700 licensed hospital beds, more than 18,000 employees, more than 3,800 physicians, greater than 557,000 emergency visits annually, more than 24,000 annual deliveries, and more than 1.3 million inpatient and outpatient visits. Tana is the analyst who does the bill for our electronic health record. So I'm going to turn it over to her now. Thank you.
Of course, you guys all know what the benefits to reporting your e-measures electronically, your measures electronically. The patient population can be identified. We can monitor those patients, and we can intervene in those patients before they go home to make sure they get every intervention they need. And on the back end of that, we can also decrease the manual abstraction of the chart. We can pull that data into a report for abstraction purposes, and even go as far as just automatically sending the data to the vendor is the ultimate goal, so that we do decrease manual abstraction. But there are issues along with quality measure reporting, the e-measures, and one of the biggest challenges we have is really the end user utilization of the discrete elements that we put in place within their workflow. And also transition from paper to electronic, and that doesn't mean literally, it means culturally. There's a thought that goes along with how paper is, which is non-discrete, and many times, even though we're on an electronic health record, we let it pass that as long as the physician documents it, no matter if it's discrete or not, that's fine. And really, we have to move past that and add another layer to that and say, we really need this discreetly. We're moving in, we have this electronic health record, we're moving in into a level where we really need to document that this discreetly. So, and another big issue for us has been limitations with our software, the software we use with our vendor. And that can be things like from the end users, sometimes, you know, they want flashing lights to, you know, bring the physician to this spot to document. And, of course, that's a limitation. But also there's philosophy differences between the way the vendor interprets the measure and the way we interpret the measure at our hospitals. And sometimes the vendor doesn't allow for enough discrete ways to capture that data according to our interpretation of that. So that's a challenge, and it creates a lot more work for us trying to capture that data. And when we're moving into this quality reporting, even though the vendor offers some quality reporting functionality, there's still a very, very high effort that's involved with the build team to coordinate all of that, research all of that, report that data out, and then also include the data elements within a workflow. It's a very high effort. It's my full-time job, and there's also others that work on this full-time as well. So it's tough. Move to the next slide. I got this slide from from Shannon Sims at Rush University, and I thought it was a great correlation between the Kubler-Ross stages of grief and quality measurement, because you really do kind of go through these stages of, you know, this isn't, you know, we need new metrics and this isn't right, my patients are sicker and that's why our scores are so low, but really we can always do better. There's always room for improvement. So we started with a gap analysis. We evaluated the CMS regulations for each data element, and we evaluated in our EHR system what capabilities we had to report that data. And again, our system gave us a model configuration. This is how you should do it within your system. And we kind of went along with that model configuration to start out with, since that's the way the vendor recommended that we use the quality reporting. So after we compared those two and came up with our strategy, we mapped the discrete data elements into our EHR reporting structure, and then we strategically placed those documentation elements into physician workflows and nursing workflows. And strategically, really, you know, we put orders in an order set, or we, you know, tried to really educate that, you know, the problem list is really important, and then based on the problem list, we created some pop-ups or best practice advisories that would kind of guide the physician in the right direction for documentation. And after we did that mapping, we went ahead, and we were doing this for meaningful use, we went ahead and did a technical validation. We wanted to make sure we could trust that any discrete documentation that was entered on the chart was actually showing up on the report. So we did simply, is the data there? Is it in the chart discretely? And did it flow over to the report? And then the second piece to that was a manual abstraction. So we took those same patients, and we wanted to know how much data is actually discrete and how much the abstractors were really finding in non-discrete locations. And we let the data analytics group take care of that. We did as much as we could from IT, and then we handed it over to the data analytics group. And this is, I'll let Amy discuss what we found. It was really interesting what we found when we looked at that information.
If you look at the blue bars on this graph, that's the technical validation piece that we confirmed that the data that was captured discreetly was being reported as discrete data. However, when you look at the red bar, that's the clinical validation piece, and it's representative of some work that we have had to do in order to improve the scores. It's representative also the fact that it's not just one single provider who's not changing their practice. It's something that we've got to work on to bring those numbers up. Same here for the VTE. Certainly. Sorry. So the orange bar is what your measure numbers actually were.
The red side, okay, the blue side is that the report pulled in all discrete data. The red side shows how much of that data was actually in a discrete format when they did a clinical validation. So uh-huh. You can look at VTE6 and say only 61% of the information actually matched the technical validation, so discrete data.
Okay. Thank you.
And some of those were really low, down in the teens, that we weren't really. And you can even go as far, I'll go as far to say this, that back on the stroke, go back two slides. One more on the stroke, like the stroke 6 there, you see it's 15%. And many of those, all it meant is that there probably wasn't data in the record, either on the technical side or the clinical side, so we weren't meeting any of those. So even if we had a 15% match, it didn't mean that the information was in the patient's record. So scroll on down to the past that one. And so we had a lot of work to do on this. So we looked at where exactly were the abstractors finding the information. It obviously wasn't where we put those strategic data elements. And we already knew those discrete documentation spots. So we really just needed that piece from the abstractor of, okay, where, if you're not finding it here, where are you finding it? So after the abstractors, we sent them a huge spreadsheet. They evaluated it, and we then looked at where those two locations differ and why they differ. And really, it turns out to be that most of our physician documentation is in notes, dictated, free text, and or they weren't documenting their reason why I don't want to order something. So it's a very common theme here. And so we went ahead and did another analysis and really looked at what are all the possible ways we could get this in a discrete format, whether it's realistic, whether it's, you know, no matter what are the options that we have, okay, and then how can we incorporate those into the workflow. So we ended up using some very unconventional ways to create discrete documentation. And what I mean from that is really moving away from the model that the vendor recommended to us and moving into more higher, more detailed, more sophisticated type of checks and balances and offering the physicians a place to document only if the patient meets certain criteria. And offering on the nursing side specific prompts if the patient falls into a specific population, which I know we're going to talk about solutions later, but really my recommendation is to push the limits of your system and not just take what the vendor recommends and go with that and try to work within those boundaries. Of course, work with your support person at your vendor, but we really have to think outside the box with this, and it's we can't always wait for the vendor to come up with a better solution. We have to take it into our own hands and figure it out for ourselves on how we're going to discreetly document that information.
That the last slide?
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you both, and now I'll, I guess, round of applause. Those were two very great presentations, and I'm sure there are tons of discussion points that will be generated from this, and Ginny is going to try to stimulate that discussion, but, you know, hopefully maybe if there are any specific questions towards the presentation, and then later on, you know, more trying to find some common solutions.
Thank you, Zahid. So those were fabulous presentations, and I think both of them had some very similar themes, but then there were also some differences that we probably can delve into. But Pam and Lindy, Tana and Amy, you guys did a great job. So hats off to you for figuring out how to really do this, and you're definitely pioneers. So what we really want to look at, as you can see from the slide, based upon some of the things that they just spoke about, what are the real best practices examples and the things that they've done related to the development and implementation of the meaningful use e-measures? And, you know, a couple of key things they talked about were processes and workflow with existing products, you know, thinking outside the box. I heard that a couple of times from folks, so those are definitely important things. The coding systems terminology issues, we can delve into that a little bit, the whole culture and change management process. But let's open it up and have folks, first of all, if you have any specific questions, let's go ahead and get those asked and then start talking about some of this detail. Alyssa.
Thank you, and thank you to all of you. Your presentations were fantastic. And just so I work for the California Hospital Association. I'm based here, and so I've been working with our CMIOs, our quality improvement leaders, trying to understand this process. And you all have just really put a very fine point on everything that I've heard and in visiting many of these hospitals. I had a couple of questions that I was hoping you guys could address. We're hearing that the process and workflow that you're undertaking for any particular measure can take anywhere from 6 to 9 months, especially if you get that off-the-shelf product that really does not work. So everything else in your for your vendor is working for a module, but they give you your CQM module, and it's just totally unworkable. Can you give me a sense of the timeline? And, I mean, you all talked about significant education targeted, your ED, your stroke, your VTE, to bring everybody along. Again, that takes time. It takes culture change. It takes workflow processes. Can you give me just a sense of the real time it takes to do this work and how attentive your vendors were to meeting those expectations and timelines?
This is Tana. It's hard to give you a timeline because we've been working on this for so long. We've implemented these changes in stages, but I would say not for each measure it takes that long. But if you take one set, like the stroke measure set, I would say it takes 6 to 9 months to because you may put in a new process or find a new way and you see a slight improvement. And then you're thinking, okay, we're missing this over here. Physicians are going here to document this. We need to put something over here. Or, you know, the nurse, what if we give the nurse something that they check to make sure everything was done before the patient goes home, like a checklist? And, you know, if something's not done, then they call the physician and clarify. And I would say that's probably right, but for an entire population, it's probably true.
Can I ask a related vendor-type question? You mentioned that sort of pushing the limit on what they provide.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that you're still within their tool set, mm-hmm. but you are pushing the limit but not bringing in some external software or
correct.
Some
yes, things. it's all within the functionality of that software system. There may be, and this comes with more experienced analysts that have been I've been in the system, working in the system for 6 years, and I really know all the different pieces of the system and what might be available. And actually, I stumbled upon what is probably going to, and I'm still working on it now, but what's probably going to be the pivotal piece that are going to turn around these measures that you see here. And I went to my technical support person and said, hey, I found this, and it sounds really great. Can I use it? And so they said yes. Even though it's not used for the intended purpose that they put it in the system for, it still works in a different part of that system. And I did get approval from them. There's no extra programming involved at all. It's functionality within the system.
So it seems like both of you had some sort of best practices recommended by your vendors, but yeah. Then you were able to extend that mm-hmm. even more. And any comments from the Phelps people around that area? Or
sure, too, for us, we really had an aggressive timeline. We began, I would say, in February of last year, and we were planning to attest last year for stage one. So in February, we began building the measures. And really, our vendor offered, we didn't gain any functionality with, we basically used the functionality we had to accomplish the measure. So the vendor had a best practice document that was helpful, although we had things in place that, you know, had to be altered. So we began attestation June 1st. So we were reporting by June 1st. Very aggressive, lots of feedback for the clinicians, lots of education, but, you know, in our case, the functionality was already present, so we didn't have to implement that.
Did you do the same type of validation? You talked about validation mm-hmm. along, and did you have some of the same results?
We did, yes. And so you do go back and you reevaluate again, and you realize that you have placed the indicator in the data capture point in the wrong place, or there is no process available. So we did have an outside vendor for reporting that was greatly helpful. So that piece of it, I think our greatest difficulty and challenge is the data capture.
So historically, the quality measurement world starts with a real deep understanding of the specifications by quality. With these new meaningful use e-measures, we see IT jumping in and just wanting to start building and capturing. How much time did you guys spend either with quality or without quality, having a good understanding of the specifications themselves, or did you go right to those vendor best practice recommendations and start building?
Well, I'm a nurse. So I'm a nurse first and IT second. So whenever, and I've been doing quality measures for 6 years, so meaningful use wasn't my first exposure to quality. And so when I started configuring heart failure, AMI, pneumonia, the spec manual, I carried it with me. And whenever I read each data element individually, and read every line about who's allowed to document this to be acceptable and who's not. And wording, there's very specific wording you have to include in your documentation. And so then I looked at the specific data element within the EHR system and made sure, did it align with the same, the CMS specs? And if it didn't, and there were many times that it didn't, and I had to go back to the vendor and say, this is wrong, this isn't in the spirit of what CMS is trying to capture, and they had to make some changes to their system. There's other things, like I was saying earlier, that they just interpret the data differently, and so we can't use that functionality that they give us. But in our system, there is not a single thing that goes in for quality that doesn't first get evaluated against the spec manual, yes.
This is Lindy. We also had the same type of process, and the fact is, but we did have quality at the table at the beginning, with IT. Of course, we have a very good working relationship with IT as well as with nursing, and so that the quality individual was right there to talk about the specific indicators, what was needed, and we're very fortunate because Pam is also a nurse, so, you know, she has that clinical background and understand the language that the quality individuals bring to the table. So there was a nice bridge between IT language and the clinical language. I think that really helped us.
Yeah, I think that's really key for long-term success. We're a vendor who works on pulling data out and reporting, and a lot of times we see this just being a very IT-focused initiative. Mm-hmm. And folks who have gone through attestation or been in the rush to a test now are trying to transition it to quality, and quality is curious at best, and sometimes resistant to taking ownership of this data at all because they weren't involved in the beginning to capture it correctly. And so it's good to hear that both you guys are a little bit of the exception to the rule. A good many of our clients don't involve quality, so I think that's really vital to the success of this long term.
Hi, I'm Evelyn Canale with the American Hospital Association. I'm actually filling in for someone who is our expert on e-measures, so I know a lot less than she does, so forgive me if this question is a little bit rudimentary, but it sounds like you all are having to do a lot of trial and error on this, and my question is just to back it up a little. In terms of the testing of e-measures, field testing, and you know, doing all of that with both the e-measures and the vendor tools, would that be something to recommend it that we do much more of that before it gets to your level? Would that help you if there had been more testing?
Well, we certainly tried to do a lot of prep work and ask. You know, we have, you know, approved workflows. The physician should go to the discharge navigator and use the discharge order set. And in the discharge order set has all the, if he used the discharge order set, he would pass the measure. They're trained that way. That's the way they're supposed to do it. But unfortunately, in our system, there's five different ways to do the same thing. And so I think that offers a lot of challenges. I don't know if you guys have the same issues. And so even though we try to steer them in the right direction, there's always going to be some way that we're not aware that they're documenting something. So we've had workouts. We've brought, you know, physicians, nurses from all of our entities to the table and asked what's the best way to do this. And even when we've done that, we've still come back after analyzing, okay, how did this change go, and still having to come back to the drawing board and either augment that with something else or, you know, put something else over here that would capture that data. And I'll say that our biggest challenge is the exclusionary measure, the exclusion criteria, is a big challenge. It's not a challenge to report on if the physician ordered a medication. It's a challenge to get our physicians to document that the patient's on comfort measures discreetly, or that the patient had an elective carotid intervention. I mean, we know they had a carotid endarterectomy, but was it elective or was it not? And that's our challenge. So I don't know if you guys have anything.
Yes, so I have a question about that because I think that's a really good point. I've heard that a lot from folks, that trying to document all the exceptions and exclusions gets very laborious, and physicians don't like having to document that, but yet at the same time sometimes I think they also don't like it if their quality measurement indicators are not showing the best performance because they haven't documented it. So is there do you have any kind of a thoughts, or have you had discussions around how much of that exception data should be captured?
Well, we, and this is my, it usually comes out of my mind, and then I ask other people in our group, okay, what do you think about, does this make sense? So we don't have hardly any patients on a clinical trial. So, and we have really hard time documenting that discreetly. So I'm throwing that one out and saying that one's the lowest on my priority list of trying to get that discreetly documented. And then the second thing is if the patient, and I'm going to use stroke, for instance. So if the patient had an elective carotid intervention. So That one's really hard for us too. But what I can do is for those patients that fall into that ischemic stroke population from the ICD-9 codes that they put on the problem list or the diagnosis area of your system, create a prompt for the physician. Okay, the patient is an ischemic stroke patient. I don't care if they're an elective carotid intervention. I've checked to see if you've documented comfort measures discreetly, and you haven't. So, doctor, tell me why you didn't order an antithrombotic for the patient to go home on. And if they, and then they have a choice, they can pick from a list, and one of their choices from the list is that the patient had an elective carotid endarterectomy or intervention. So that's sort of how we are doing it right now. It's probably not the best way to do it, and it may evolve into something else, but that's how we do it now. So we can't capture all of our exclusions, but we can capture some of them. And then if the patient doesn't fall into any of those exclusions, we still ask the physician to answer the question, unfortunately. Does that answer your question? Okay.
Yeah, thank you. Does anybody have any other specific questions for our speakers? Katarina.
Thank you. First off, thanks for the presentation. That was great. I'm just curious, now that you've been through this process, clearly you've involved quality in that, and one of the questions I get asked by a lot in a consulting role is, how should we as a facility structure ourselves? And so do you have any advice or thought points to carry forward about what you might think in the out years is an optimal structure for a facility of, you know, you have a separate informatics department. Do you need to bring a permanent quality person in that is actually embedded because there's sufficient workload? Is simply the teaming the right way to do that? But some thoughts about an organizational structure that supports the work you've done.
This is Pam from Phelps County Regional. I think one piece that sometimes is missing is having a physician champion. The medical piece is really important, and we don't always accomplish that. We have a physician advisory committee that we've used for that purpose, but even having one person who is a peer who can go to other physicians and talk to them about the measures and talk to them about their compliance with the measures. Also, I will say embedding in some kind of accountability or I don't want to say reward system, but our physicians are very competitive. And they're really ambitious, high achievers. They like to be on the top. And so in taking some of the lessons learned from other projects like CPOE, posting their compliance for all to see is probably another step that we'll take because we've seen great accomplishments in that with physician compliance.
Go ahead.
Just real quick, this is Lindy Merrow. I think one of the important things is when you're looking at a structure, it depends on the size of your institution. Our size, I was able to use quality individuals. They still have other tasks that they need to complete, but we were able to allow them to work on this project. And they're the faces with the physicians, so they have good working relationships with the physicians. So working on this project was just part of their job duties. I think if you get into a larger institution, you may have to look at that, but I think it can be done in a smaller institution with your current quality staff.
I believe, and this is how we've done it, and we thought really when we were starting to configure the quality measures that it was going to be about a six-month job, and then, the builder could move on to something else. And it really, it's an ongoing, and I don't see it's a full-time job for me, and we are bringing on another person. It could be a full-time job for two people, and we treat our 14 hospital system as one. So everybody has one build, not specific for each entity. And so I think it would probably still take the same number of people at our large hospital as it probably would for a single hospital. But it's when you start looking at all of the requirements that we're having to report on, it is a full-time job just trying to meet all of the requirements that the hospitals are having to meet these days. And we incorporate people who are dedicated to in the quality departments themselves. We all meet together. But as far as IT, one full-time person, maybe one and a half people would be good.
Deborah.
Thank you. Just to answer also to your question about the involving all the various stakeholders when you're going through this implementation, previously I worked for a large hospital system in the Baltimore, Washington area. And so when we were going through the various implementations and we're talking about quality reporting and meaningful use reporting from end to end, we were able to have representatives from every single stakeholder at the table from the beginning. So it's critical. It's important. I like your statement about the physician champion, the executive leader buy-in. It's very important. But again, have quality, have IT, have nursing, physicians, the additional folks that are clinicians documenting, and get every perspective at the beginning from the discussion. You waste no time if you're going to have a better output at the end if you put in the time at the beginning. Major projects have had to be pulled because of lack of attention to workflow and multi-stakeholder buy-in. So a great point to bring up and to say that it doesn't matter how large or small your institution is, it's critical. And equally as important is then that communication with the vendor about the needs of the hospital, getting that out there on the table, having that dialogue and making sure that you get the vendor who's working for you to help you get a successful product.
So I'd like to, if I may, take a couple minutes to go over the vendor perspective on all of this. Just a couple of things that I wanted to talk about. First of all is timing. So our hospitals want to have 9 months, let's say, to work through their processes, establish best practice, work with their clinicians to make sure that their numbers are in a range that they feel comfortable with, and so on. Which is great. We really want to do that. So we figure for stage two that we need to be, in order to give the hospitals that much time, we have to be code complete by the end of September at the latest. And that means, for all of you who I'm sure realize this, the final rules won't even be out probably, and we have to be code complete. And so there are 34 additional acute measures in this. Do we do them all? Do we do a subset of them? How do we figure out what subset? And what we did for stage one was we took all the data elements and we said we need a method to gather all this data. So the easiest thing for us to do is to create a form that somebody has to go through. And our client said, well, this looks like retrospective reporting, you know, that somebody's going to have to do a chart review in order to fill this out. And we worked with them to say, you know, you can move some of these data elements in other places. But ultimately, what we ended up doing was we went through what we called our automation project. So what we said was, what we'd really like to do is to figure out how to gather the data as part of the workflow of the clinicians, rather than there being, you know, a process that somebody has to go through at the end and fill out this form. And as we went through that automation project, what we discovered, obviously, is that every single one of our clients does things differently. They have a different workflow, and they didn't want us to say, this is how you're going to do it so that we can count it, right? They wanted us to make it work with their workflow. And what we ended up having to do, which is ever so painful, is for some data elements, we have 4 or 5 different ways that people can record that data. in order for it to work for every customer. And so it's our code is now incredibly complicated with all these rules to say, okay, first you look here. If you can't find the data there, then you look here. And if you don't find the data there, then you have to go and look here. And it's very complicated. It's very difficult to come up with measures and data gathering that will work for every different hospital. Very challenging.
That's a really good point. And I think one of the things that I was hearing you bring up, as far as some of the challenges I think we've all felt, is the timing issue. I mean, and we all know that, I mean, this is really a very new world, even though I know Dr. Bastashari talked about the fact we've been working on this for 5 years. Well, clinical quality measures being able to be collected electronically, maybe not so much, maybe not so many years. And we're definitely all learning together, I think, about what the best practices are. We've heard a lot today, I think, already about best practices and being able to ensure what Deborah brought up about making sure you've got a team of folks representative of all the different areas that have got to collaborate on this, rather than it just be an IT project or just a quality project, et cetera. And that kind of brings us back to what we're really looking at right now, too, around best practices. Are there other best practices that either our speakers have mentioned or that you all know of that we should be aware of and document as part of this effort so we can then share it with everybody?
I really want to reiterate what some of the speakers have already said, which is we find among our clients, by the way, this is Jan Hinley from GE Healthcare. What we found with our clients is having a clinician advocate makes an enormous amount of difference. Absolutely enormous.
Really good point.
I believe also education. There's so much education that we do. Our quality departments at every hospital, we have something called the Core Measures Boot Camp, and the nurses come to it, and the nurses really educate the nurses about the requirements, and a lot of times the nurses will kind of keep the physicians in line a little bit because they're, and I think the accountability is a big piece as well, making somebody accountable, like you guys were saying. But it's really important to have a quality involved within that education.
I think keeping the sort of same theme of is there a best practice around documenting a certain thing a certain way? Because I know, Tana, you mentioned in your comments earlier that the reason some of your rates were so low for the clinical validation was because the same thing can be documented in five different ways, and not all of it was picked up by your software, and that's what you were referring to. And I know Kristen here was smiling because that's the bane of her existence here, that, how many places do you look at, or how many places should the software be programmed to look at? Because the five times that you have already programmed in the next facility will be the sixth time. There's some way. So my question is for both of you, since you guys have been dealing with physicians, and I sort of wear both hats sometimes, so I know the issue from both sides. Do you ever see maybe down the road that you will be able to have consensus on your physicians documenting things just one way? For the critical data elements, because to me that sort of gets the heart of the best practice documentation, that will you be able to sell a best practice that you will say, well, in our 13 hospitals, we will just document this thing this way?
That's a scary question to answer. I think there are some places, some areas that we could improve or not allow the physician to go, only place orders within a navigator, rounding navigator, things like that. But it's so hard because you guys have physicians that dictate
And then we have physicians that are really savvy with the system, and they use their templates, and they use, you know, they use the structured data that we've given them. And we have usually around four different places like you do. And I think that's a long-term goal. A very long-term goal is probably to have a single source of truth. But realistically, I can't see right now that that's where I think we have to get our heads above water just a little bit on this, and then we can move forward.
I think, too, from our perspective, we met with the Physician Advisory Committee this week, and we were talking about structured data. And their eyes were huge, and, you know, and one of the physicians said, I hate that. I really hate that because they're so ingrained in dictation or dragon. Or, but I think with the use of evidence-based practice sets, for certain measures, we would be able to do that. I think that they, because they didn't just, they didn't throw anything. We have progression. and they've accepted, you know, being persistent and just representing that in the intent, I think is really, really meaningful to the physicians. And I think that they have embraced structured data in certain places. So I think we're going to get there. It would be great if technology were more advanced so that they could have some dictation application that would populate structured fields. But we have to live in our day-to-day, so I think we are going to get there, though.
Teresa Hart, Department of Defense. We are actually taking that hill. We are now standardizing our medical record with our called CPGs, Clinical Practice Guidelines, and we're dropping those in. We're also trying to look ahead into coding. God forbid, let's not talk about, you know, ICD-10s. But trying to drop coding into some of the procedures behind the data element so that it becomes less of a discussion between the provider and the coder, because that ends up being a huge issue somewhere down the line where the element comes out as compliant or not compliant, and then you look back and you say, no, not really. They saw it as this, and we saw it as that. So we are trying to do that, and we're trying to standardize. We have probably 59 active hospital facilities throughout the world, with quite a few branch medical clinics, freestanding. So we have standardized to one documentation system, and that is relatively recent, within the last 2 years. And now we're trying to standardize within those systems the different documentation pieces. And the pieces we're looking at are the hotspots: admission, HMP, discharge, and then the med recs. Those are, you know, the big hills that we're taking first, because if we can do those and we can make sure that we're meeting the outcome goals or at least those metrics, then it's going to make sense if we go back a little bit and do progress notes or, you know, something along those lines. So just getting everybody to think the same thoughts, really saying that this is evidence-based, here's the clinical practice guideline, tell me what part of this you don't like, and that's hard for them to say. Other than, and we certainly have a very different population than many of you, because we don't get funding. You know, we are sort of, you know, the brother and sister of the funding source as part of the federal government, and we don't reimburse our providers. But within the military system, allocation of resources from the Department of Defense are allocated to the different treatment facilities, hospitals, based on their compliance with different metrics. So if you have a pot of $20 and you have 15 different places, you play nice, we'll give you $5 and somebody else may get one. So there is that ability within the Department of Defense to really look at those metrics. So it's not been an easy process. It's been something we've been working on for the past 9 months, but we have perinatal, which is my specialty, out in beta, and OR, which was a huge piece for us, is going to come out in beta in like the next 2 weeks. So those, I think, are very important things. It's never easy, but if you just choose what's going to make the biggest difference, and for us, as I said, it was admission and discharge, trying to look at those standardizations and then the MedRec. So look at where you can find those pieces. So,
well, we found that it's ever so important to try to build the gathering of the data into the clinician's workflow, whatever it is that they're comfortable with, that is the best way of getting good data. So for some of our clients, they're doing things like order sets, even down to including what we call the negation rationale. So why didn't you do something? So there's an order for, I didn't do it because the patient didn't, for patient reasons. There's an order for, I didn't do it for medical reasons or whatever. Sometimes more explicit than that. But another thing that we're looking at is that we've developed a documentation tool for the clinicians, and we're trying to work the gathering of the quality measure data into the templates that are used for the structured documentation, so that, again, the clinicians it will be part of their documentation process that they actually have those quality measure data elements. It does, however, mean that we have to build specific things for each set of data elements, right? So for each set of new measure areas. So, you know, when we move to AMI, there'll be a whole new set of data elements and exclusion criteria and all of that, and we'll have to build new templates around that. And I'm sure you all in the implementation side, you have the same thing, that for each new area of measures that we're gathering data on, you have to look at the workflows and figure out how to put it seamlessly there.
And we've had a challenge I'll start by our physicians. We don't employ our physicians, so we sort of have to work around that. You know, we can't make them do anything, and so we thought about making specific templates for specific, you know, an AMI discharge summary or an AMI H&P and things like that. I think it became so that they wouldn't pick the right template. Like, we couldn't make them use the right template. And so we kind of went away from that. And so we were really having a hard time. And I wonder if anybody else has a solution that, so we have one H&P template, and we don't want to burden the physicians with having to answer AMI questions if the patient's not an AMI patient. So what do you guys do in that situation? Or do you have separate templates?
Our vendor has, we have the H&P, and we have all the important thing that is good for every service. And then we have little click boxes that will blow up. So if this person has a diagnosis of AMI, you click it and it blows up, and those are all the things you need to do. So there's a standardized format, and then as you need things, so are you discharging them home on Coumadin? You know? So, and you can check none of the above, or you can check all of the above, and when you check them, then there's blowouts for, now I got to know this if you send them home on this, and now I got to know this. But you're sending home fine and benign, you know, you don't want to do it. So it's almost like an accordion where it's short and sweet, and then you click on this and that piece opens or that piece opens depending upon, you know, what the diagnosis is. You just have to sort of figure out how you want to segment that.
So you base it off of the diagnosis. Do you have them, do they have the choice to go to that?
No.
Area? It just takes them and they ask, does
that
this patient
is
have
the discharge H&P?
Okay. And you ask them something like, do they have an AMI? Did they have an AMI?
Right.
Or did they have
And we can do stuff that, like, doesn't print out.
Yeah.
So you have these non-printing instructions.
Mm-hmm.
Are you discharging a patient with the following diagnoses or conditions? And then they can pick. And then really all their discharge instructions and everything sort of fall out. So other than scrolling and making it a longer thing, mm-hmm. it really is helpful to them because then they don't have to remember. It's going to have all the different pieces of, you know, they have a care plan and this is what they're going to do. I mean, one of our bigger challenges is the discharge of with children and the asthma and the follow-up plan. Does the child have an asthma plan? Do they have, you know, a rescue?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, you know, is this an adult or an infant or adult and a child? And if it's not a child, you don't have to check that. But if it is, then does the child have a diagnosis of asthma? You know, yes or no, and then you can populate all these in.
I think, this is Pam from Phelps County. I agree that, you know, we are only reporting the stage one e-measures currently electronically. So we did develop a discharge instruction for our discharge template for stroke, although I can see as this grows that it really needs to be just one place for the physician to go and then utilize some kind of clinical decision support that would map them through. And in saying that, we were talking about the structure of who's involved in this. I think a programmer is really important because the functionality of the vendors is such that you need more. So you need programming in the background that will help guide, you know, the clinician to the right path. So they would, it starts with the diagnosis, you know, they would have to document that, but then it would guide them to the necessary requirements because they can't remember all of them.
That's a really good point in bringing up the clinical decision support piece of this, as we know that's something that's being proposed for stage two. And there's a lot of different ways to do clinical decision support, but that would be very important, I think, as we get more and more quality measures that we need to build into our systems. Should we break now? Okay, we're going to break for lunch. We've gone over a few minutes.
But we were scheduled for about a 20-minute break. So for those of you on the phone, we'll be coming back about 12:25. Does that suffice for everybody's needs? Lunch will be over on the table. There are bag lunches based on your selection. Again, restrooms are out the door. Just keep going straight. And any other questions, please come grab me and let me know.
It's going well. It's interesting, but it's kind of like the stuff that we've already done, you know, just another hospital's point of view of doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm getting a few pearls, but not a whole lot of information. How about you?
Well, a lot of the discussion is actually a little over my head, because they're not really talking about metrics or measures so much as the systems behind the measures. The presentation, unfortunately, I missed most of the presentation because I had to do my drive way in.
Oh.
So I thought, well, I'll just run right up. It'll take, you know, 5 minutes for them to weigh me, and then I can run back down, and hopefully they'll have just finished setting up the call because they're, like, doing roll call and, you know, all this other stuff. So I went upstairs, and the guy up there was having some sort of paperwork. I ended up in this long line.
Okay.
By the time I got my weigh-in done and got back down, they had already done all the
paperwork.
They looked like they would have been interesting. They talked a lot about all the work that was done to scrub the data before they could actually make use. And how, when we're talking about clinical data analytics, that's a step that needs to be attended to. You know, first you've got to deal with the issue of all of your different systems that may or may not talk to each other.
Right.
Nobody's really talked about any solutions there. Then they talked about from there you can't just start making use of the data. From there you've got to have some process by which you validate of your data. And an example they gave was, okay, just hypertensive patients. Problemless diagnosis of hypertension and a numerical systolic and diastolic blood pressure. That, using that system, we have 80,000 patients who are hypertensive and need to be followed for that. But when you look down into it, quite a few of those patients received that diagnosis on the problem with the very time they were hospitalized under high stress and acutely ill. How many of those 80,000 actually require follow-up for hypertension?
Oh, wow.
So they had to do a scrub process and ended up with only like 20,000 patients.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that's on the EP side of things.
Yeah.
Wow. I wouldn't, I mean, wow.
So that's the kind of stuff that they're talking about.
So how do you actually
Okay, if I can ask everybody to bring it on in. We do have some work to get back to this afternoon. This is a working lunch, so feel free to continue eating your lunch. And I'll pass it back to our track leaders to continue our discussions. Again, if you have any questions, please let us know.
Thanks, Juliet. And everybody now is eating, so I don't have my mouth full right now, so I'll talk as he does. So I think we had a really great discussion this morning. One of the things that we really wanted to hone in on is the question that you all see up on the slides right now. And that is, and we've talked a little bit about this, but that's around the mechanisms to enhance data and workflow. What can we really do to actually understand the data workflow and define what our expectations are for EHRs and other clinical applications? What challenges exist with products and not just with existing products, but maybe even with the process, the products and the process that we're expecting to be able to collect this data with? And then are there workflow or staffing issues that actually are constraining our implementation and causing us to not be as effective as we'd like to be? So I'll kind of open that up for discussion from everyone. Everyone's eating. No one wants to talk. So when we think about data workflow, are there, you know, one of the things I've heard from our customers is that some of the challenge is around the fact that we're expecting physicians to actually document data that they are not used to documenting. We've talked a little bit about that, but, like, are there specifics around that that we want to talk about? Like, for example, we know the problem list is something that really is critical in having that documented in order to drive the quality measures. But in an acute care setting, a lot of times we've heard that physicians aren't really used to having to manage to a problem list. Is that true? Is that something you found or not found and found ways around that?
This is Tana. We have that problem. And it's the physicians, you know, they used to just put everything in a note. The problem was in the note, and now, you know, we're kind of asking them to go outside of their note and put it in the problem list. And so we, even though we pushed really hard on our physicians to start using the problem list, it's a slow adoption rate. And so we really needed to capture bottom line before we could really do anything. We have to identify the patient. And so we have the quality people, the quality staff at each of our hospitals. We gave them security to put a problem on the problem list if there's explicit documentation from the physician that says this is a heart failure patient or this is a stroke patient. And that's the only time they're allowed. They can't infer anything from symptoms, anything like that. And so then they can put a problem on the problem list. And it's helped us quite a bit just in identifying our patients. And then from that identification, we can use our clinical decision support tools and send them to the right order sets and things like that.
Do you all feel that the current standards that are in there for let's say workflow, and I think Ginny mentioned one of them being problem list. So the existing standards in terms of, you know, SNOMED, ICD-9, all of those things that need to be captured and need to be incorporated into the workflow, do you have any recommendations as to are they adequate for now, or is there any recommendation we could make in terms of how they could be enhanced to improve the workflow for documentation? No? Any ideas around that?
No, really, I think they're adequate. Just making sure that whatever measure that we specifically choose to report or are asked to report, that we would have all of the detail around that, meaning all of the codes would be incorporated in that. And there wouldn't require workarounds. That would be really important. But I think the standardized nomenclature seems appropriate.
So you mentioned one of the sort of shortfalls of the HITSPE document that the branded drugs were not part of the Joint Commission RX norm value set. So I guess that would be one specific example that the standards are incorporated in a way that reflects clinical practice, I suppose.
So one thing I wanted to say about this is that the HITSPE document only uses SNOMED, and we found that very difficult because it meant that we were mapping SNOMED to ICD-9 to ICD-10, et cetera. And that's a very difficult task. On the ambulatory side, the NQF measures had multiple nomenclatures listed for different elements. So they would have ICD-9, they would have SNOMED, they would have ICD-10, which weren't always right, but at least they had them. And so from my perspective, that's a weakness of the inpatient specifications.
Yeah, Debbie?
That's very, very true, and we received a lot of input about that from sites using many other vocabulary sets other than SNOMED. What I've learned, certainly SNOMED is, especially with the expansion of it, is much more clinically focused and could give specificity to those data elements. But moving forward, we are including all appropriate code sets in the respecification of any of the hospital measures. And so we had the HITSPE measures in Meaningful Use Stage 1, and there were a number of issues that many of you brought forth about those specifications, and so we had an initiative underway where we updated those specifications and addressed many of those issues, and that's the version 1.2 of the HITSPE specifications. Currently, what's underway is look at those measures with the measure developers, the measure stewards, and they are putting those measures into the HQMF format completely and aligning those measure specifications with the other measures that are proposed for Stage 2. So we are trying to standardize the approach for electronic specification of the clinical quality measures that we propose in the EHR incentive program on the ambulatory side and the hospital side. So you can look at a measure, and they will be in HQMF format, and they will these electronic specifications will include all appropriate code sets for that measure, and we hope that that will help alleviate some of the challenges that you all had in Stage 1.
So I guess one of the recommendations would be to, along those lines, just to say that if the specifications as well as the standards are all aligned with the clinical documentation, then that would reduce the problems that were encountered. Alignment of the standards with the clinical documentation workflow and the specifications.
Right. And we've done some work with various contractors looking at the end-to-end reporting process of clinical quality measures, looking at data capture issues, the calculation issues, the export and the reporting issues. CMS is aware and trying to listen and then respond to the challenges that are there and be aware of what's going on in the clinical, the real clinical world, in the hospitals, in the physician practice settings, and trying to incorporate code sets that are used and workflows that are common, and trying to make it as user-friendly and implementable as we can. So, good point.
So that sounds like another point I was going to bring up, and the workflow piece is, now that we're looking at the development of quality measures with electronic measurement, one of the things that seems like it would be very helpful, we had a lot of measures that for stage one were, and for stage two potentially, are retooled measures. So they're measures that were taken from measures that have typically been captured using chart abstraction or claims data or a hybrid method of both. So does it sound like one of the things we should be looking at then, based on what Debbie just said, is determining how to develop new measures that are really driven off the actual data workflow and the data that we know we can expect to capture in an EHR? Is that something that everybody thinks is important?
So, like the concept of de novo measures that are more designed for EHR data capture.
Which is, I think, where we're trying to head. How about that last bullet point about workflow or staffing issues? We definitely talked about the fact that it's important to have a physician champion, and it's important to have different people involved and different stakeholders, but it also sounds like with the two exemplars that we had, that they have a lot of dedicated people working on this. And I'm not sure that every healthcare organization has the luxury kind of having that many dedicated folks. So what do we think, you know, what should be the staffing requirements? How do people kind of address that? What's the challenge there?
This is Pam from Phelps County. You know, we talked about kind of the core team for implementation, which was quality, IT, clinicians. But I think, too, really bringing in the bedside clinician, because we were just talking about efficiency issues and productivity issues with physicians, especially now. They feel like they've seen decreased productivity in implementation of documentation for these types of things, and bringing them to the table, I think, early in the process is really important, because we can build lots of things that may not work.
That's a good point. How do you convince them, though, there's some kind of return on investment for their time? Is that something you can show them yet, or is there a hope that you will eventually be able to show them that capability? Everyone's silent.
That is a key point, though, is that, you know, you bring the value to the physician. And one thing, I mean, all physicians and clinicians, they want to improve patients' outcome. They're not necessarily bought in to the fact that what we've said is evidence-based or prescribed is going to do that. So educating and learning from them also, you know, their practice, I think really helps them be more involved.
Actually, a very interesting point, now that we're sort of discussing this in terms of just purely from the incentive standpoint, since we're discussing someone's productivity and the return on investment for that productivity, the physician sort of incentive in the ambulatory care is somewhat different from their incentive in the inpatient setting. In the ambulatory care, you can certainly use the pay-for-performance type of things for quality reporting itself, and that usually will get someone's attention. But on the hospital side, even if there is a pay-for-performance framework for these reports, unless it's in some sort of a shared savings ACO-type framework, they don't view that as an incentive for themselves. It's an incentive for the hospital, obviously. So I think in the inpatient setting, at least until those payment mechanisms and reforms take place, perhaps one way to sort of get physician buy-in is really, again, come back to the notion that measurement is really measuring clinical practice guidelines at the end of the day. And so if you steer them more towards clinical decision support, improving their performance, that perhaps would be something that you might get a little bit more buy-in. Is that sort of an accurate way to frame that issue?
This is Tana with THR. That is very accurate. It's the how to do that.
Right, right. Have you tried to sort of, you know, instead of focus much more on, well, we have to do this reporting, do you sort of consciously try to kind of bring out the clinical decision support angle a little bit more, and that it improves the quality and performance, mm-hmm. as opposed to just simply reporting to CMS and get the money?
We learned real quickly that you don't go to clinicians and say we want to do this for reporting purposes. They don't, you know, and I'm a clinician, you know, you don't say that. So really you do have to emphasize this is an evidence-based practice. You know, it's best care for our patients types of information. And nurses I've seen really they really identify with that, and they seem to really want to do what's right for the patient. A challenge that we see with physicians is that they read so much research. They're up on the latest research, and sometimes the latest research isn't exactly what is required from them for the patients. And so it's a little more difficult to try to get them to, okay, so you want to prescribe a different medication, that's fine, but just say why you don't want to prescribe this medication. You know, it's evidence-based. This medication is proven to be, you know.
So actually you have brought up another point that we have not even discussed so far, that some of your physicians are kind of, you know, like the jockeys finishing ahead of the horse in some ways, that they are actually perhaps even ahead of the guideline, because there is a cycle of update of the guidelines, and they might be coming in and saying they want to do something which may be supported by an article they'll bring up, but perhaps not supported necessarily by a guideline. So that's another tricky issue. You know, how do you address that type of scenario?
We're trying to get away from the term best practice, because that keeps changing, and we're going to leading practice. And then that's a little bit more palatable for everybody. This is what most people are doing. It's the leading practice, because you're right. I mean, we have folks doing the research, so they don't want to go backwards and say, I don't want to do this. So, but the leading practice is, if you're going to, you know, do something outside the leading practice, then tell us. So, because best practice feels like it's, you know, this rigid little box, and if you're not best, you're worst. And nobody wants to be worse. So if you do leading, you know that's going to be a leapfrog at some point, and there's going to be another leading and another leading versus how do you get more better.
So should we actually make that as a recommendation, that we would consider using leading practices as opposed to best practice? I don't know. It's open for discussion. Anyone have thoughts on that?
And I think it's kind of the leading versus the best versus the evidence-based, which is something we hear a lot about, too. And we know that often physicians push back a bit on all of that. So how do we get around that? What's the best way to?
The problem with evidence is by the time it's published, you're moving on to the next thing.
Right.
So evidence-based needs to be your baseline. It needs to not be your penultimate.
Great point.
So, I mean, I think we have to, you know, watch that. So evidence-based, it needs to be evidence-based, but that doesn't mean it's limited to evidence-based.
But if your quality measures are measuring according to the currently published standards of care and you're pushing the envelope, how can we set it up so that you still get to count?
Right.
Right.
The comparativeness has to be based on certain established practice. So, yeah. So I think you pointed out that's the minimum bar, in a sense, that you have to reach. But I suppose that from the standpoint of comparability, I think it has to be at that level, because otherwise if you don't have any standardization of what you're measuring, how are you going to compare people to each other? So
this is Tana from THR. Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to comment on her use of the word leading practice, and I really think that's a great word to use instead of best, because best is really only one definition for best. Mm-hmm. And leading, it's not the best. It's what most people are doing, and it's evidence-based, but it may not be what this physician wants to do with this patient. And I think that's a great word to use instead. It really kind of broadens the definition a little bit.
It does have a forward and, mm-hmm. Better connotation, mm-hmm. But doesn't necessarily be...
Yeah, absolutely. Good point.
So I have a question. How do you account in your EHRs for the gap in time when quality measurement specifications can catch up with the new recommendations of leading practice? Because we're questioning that at CMS. What is the best timeline to publish electronic specifications? We know there will be updates throughout the year that are required. What is reasonable for you all to receive those updates in a timeline that will not cause the clinicians to say, I am not documenting this because it is not what's now recommended? And so, we're struggling with that electronic specification definition and updating, and how long it would take to incorporate it into an EHR and some of those issues. So to go one step further from what you've discussed about best practices, do you have any comments or how you've handled that up to this point?
This is Pam from Phelps County. I know we had a situation with one of the stroke measures that when we implemented the quality measure for stroke, one of the ED physicians immediately said, well, we just received an update from emergency medicine that this is, there's a new indicator, or there's a new best practice, best standard evidence-based practice. And so I don't know how we'll keep up with that. Certainly if there's something latest and breaking, you have to publish that. But I think almost yearly updates would be required. I don't know if anything more frequent than that would be doable. I don't know what everybody else thinks on the clinician side, right?
I think a lot of this comes back to getting physicians to document whether it's good care for patient A versus good care for patient B, or best practice leading practice, is getting them to document contraindications or reasons for not following a leading practice correctly. So mm-hmm. We've gone through validation with large numbers of hospitals, and very small percentage of patients are excluded because of contraindications. Physicians just don't document that well. And so if that value set, that the contraindication value set, can be used to designate this was not good for patient A but was good for patient B, or this is no longer a leading practice, that's where you can really use the data you capture for comparative purposes, because the physician will decide that, hey, this patient is not a typical stroke 2 patient, I want them excluded, or this is no longer the best practice, I'm going to exclude them. But I'd like to hear from you guys, from a contraindication or physician documentation of why something wasn't done, is that a struggle for you? Yeah, so they're very, very good at documenting why they did something, not very good at documenting why they didn't do something.
And right.
I think that a lot of that lies
right.
here.
And if you really think about it, that can only be done in one of two ways. It can either be done at the point that they are making the decision, or afterwards someone asks them to do it or challenges them, i.e., put a checkbox or something. So that's why, again, I think the former is more trying to embed it into a clinical decision support type of framework, and there you don't want to have them do it for every patient, and I think we touched upon that also. So you need to hopefully be able to identify the problem that patient has early on, and that's where the problem list is very important, because if that gets generated up front, then at least you have a chance that you can trigger off certain decision support things, either through order entry or however you want to do it. But that's kind of the chicken or the egg. You know, you really need to, if you're going to serve them something, however you choose to do it, at the point of care that is tied to a certain condition or a certain problem, you need to be able to identify that problem up front. So it is that whole paradigm, which I assume all of you are sort of working towards, which eventually will be the key. Because the other option is always that once the thing has already happened, the person has not done it, and then someone else reviews it, or the system finds out it was not done later on, and then queries the physician, and that's sort of where you get the pushback. You know, that's sort of an added workload for them, having to answer those questions, not in the context of what they're doing, but afterwards.
So, right? I know I spoke before. My name is Kendall Webb. I'm an ED doc down in Florida. And so a lot of these issues, at least for me, I work in a busy level one trauma academic center. And I just took a, we went live in January, and I just took a 40% hit in my productivity, which means my patients are now waiting an extra 6, 7, 8 hours in the waiting room. And I am actually taking patients out of the waiting room and into resus. And now, from my perspective, from the clinician's perspective, do you want me to spend my time taking care of patients, or do you want me to take my time documenting? And I just took a 40% hit. Now you're going to add a CDS to that. I'm going to take a bigger hit. I'm going to be taking care of less patients. My patients are, I'm spending a lot of time. I watch my residents, you know, and they're spending a lot of time on the computer and a lot less time actually taking care of patients. And that's hard for us to swallow.
Where were you?
Whatever we put in, we have to be careful that it's not big and taking a whole bunch more time.
I'm glad at least there is one more physician. I thought maybe I was the only one having to fend off with all these nurses around.
We love you.
So really, I mean, that is actually, I mean, how would you propose to solve that problem?
Because, yeah, I was going to ask
you
the
know,
same
clearly,
question.
Clearly, that is the issue, because, you know, if you're going to ask someone to document more, they're going to have less time to do something else. But what's the right balance where we accomplish this as well as that?
Yeah. And I think that's going to be a very difficult call. I mean, I work in a very different place than she does. I work in a place where, you know, I never know when the next MCI is coming.
And the ED is probably one of the more challenging places to try to figure out how to be able to do that capture of documentation while not impeding workflow and patient care.
Right, and so that's one of the more challenging. The other thing that's very frustrating is that a lot of the best practice or leading practices that come down come from other specialties and contradict with what we get in our studies. And because we deal with everybody else out there, so our studies for the acute patient who shows up looking like they're having an MI, you know, the TIMI score was great from cards, but does it really work all that well? Not so much. It does okay. But where we have conflicts and we're kind of tied to a mandate that we don't think is valid, I think that's another place that we have to be very careful, is, you know, looking at not just, you know, being, it's easy for the cardiologist who admits the patient but doesn't see the patient up front to say, well, the ED doc should have known. But they weren't there. So I think we have to be careful if we're going to put CDS in that it applies appropriately to the places that we put it and not just take, say, a cardiology measure and try to apply it in the emergency department where we can't really implement it because it's only going to frustrate us and it's not going to serve any good.
But you would subscribe to the notion that given those two choices, I guess you would still agree that we should lean more towards the CDS and workflow built into that, even though it might be optimized for the emergency room.
If you can optimize it for the emergency room, yes. And, you know, I spent a lot of time. I actually also have a software engineering degree, so I was our champion when we implemented. And I spent a lot of time explaining to people that three clicks doesn't seem like that much until you do it six times an hour times 12 hours. Mm-hmm. And then it does, especially if you're clicking from screen and waiting for the screen to come up, and it adds up. And I think that those are the kinds of things we talked about early in the keynote speech, usability. We've really got to focus on usability because we're having a lot of trouble. I'm having a lot of trouble. I've done everything I can with the vendor that we have to make our system as usable as possible, and still we have, if you don't do everything in exactly the stepwise fashion that it's supposed to be done, everything from step X that you didn't do the way they expected you to do it, nothing is where they expect it to be. So you just, even though you're doing everything that you think you are supposed to be doing, it's not getting into the system the way billers and coders, and it's not getting into the system in any way that we're going to be able to use the data, because we can't be sure where the data is. Did I document it correctly and I just missed that one click? That's what we're running into now. That's what we're looking at now. Those are the things we're looking at now.
That was a really good point on usability. No, I was going to bring that up, but you did first.
We need to put that on.
That's definitely one of our recommendations, and there is a lot more focus on that now, and I think rightly so. If we're going to expect all this data to be collected and thinking about the workflow, usability has to be one of the primary focuses.
So from a vendor perspective, they need to focus much more on the usability as it pertains to quality. It's a quality issue as much as it is a issue for them to have a good product. It impacts workflow that impacts quality measurement.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So that's sort of one thing.
Safety is a big piece of it.
And then I think the other point that we heard earlier was in both cases that don't be afraid to push the envelope a little bit on your own within the sandbox that, you know, folks have defined for you. But if, you know, it looks like in both cases it was possible to go beyond what was recommended as a best practice, quote unquote, right? So that would be one of the other recommendations in this context in terms of, you know, workflow capture, et cetera.
You know, too, Dr. Butt, this is Pam from Phelps County. I just had a comment about how we view the medical record in our documentation as clinicians. In the past, it's really been focused on medical legal documentation and communication, but we really haven't thought of it necessarily in terms of improving outcome. So our culture really doesn't look at the record that way yet. So changing it so that we don't decrease efficiency, as she said, which we have done already, and you know, that we actually improve efficiency, but also that we start to educate our clinicians that this is actually going to be a tool to improve outcome, because I don't think we see it that way.
Good point. Anything else? Does anybody have anything else that they're thinking about on this topic of really looking at the data and workflow capabilities?
I'll just add something. So we've heard things like think outside the box, or, you know, stay within the sandbox, but that sandbox keeps getting smaller and smaller for the hospital. You know, you start with a big sandbox, which is the HITSB specification. Then the vendor comes back and says, okay, this is how you can solve it within our flexibility. And then maybe you have another vendor in there that says, all right, this is how you can actually report it within our. So the sandbox gets narrower and narrower for the hospital and the clinician. So it's very easy to say, think outside the box or push your vendor, but the vendors are going to have, everyone has constraints all the way through this to get CMS the data requirements that they're looking for. So that sandbox is very small, even though it starts off very large. And so the hospitals, unfortunately, don't have as much flexibility as you think they would have. You know? So I would just be careful that us as a group saying, oh, think outside the box and push your vendors, because that just, it's a very tough, easy to say, very tough to accomplish.
That's a good.
This is Tana with THR. And just to piggyback off of that, to think outside the box, but I don't agree. I do think you should try to, you know, tell your vendor what you need, but I'm certainly not suggesting that you push the vendor or put pressure on the vendor
by any means. It's simply a, you know, look at functionality that your vendor has already given you and look at it in a different way than what it's maybe its intended use, but it may have a much broader benefit. So I definitely don't want to go on the record as saying to push your vendor. I don't want to say that. So.
Well, you know, sometimes we need to be pushed, so I'll say that. But, no, I think that what we've heard really more than anything, especially this morning, was being able to be collaborative, being able to be partners is really critical to being able to do this. Because we're all learning from each other and kind of on this journey together. Yeah. So
really, you know, IT quality and the vendors are really sort of three key stakeholders with the blessing of the... And with, that's what I'm saying, the clinicians as well. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, because they know that your productivity is down 40%.
So how do you propose actually bringing them?
I don't know about that, but I think
that's what I'm saying.
Right.
I get your point.
Right.
I see your point.
Right.
And in the end, this is all about the patient.
Right. And we're doing this to solve it for the patient. Right.
But you can't really physically bring a patient to the table as you're doing it. Somehow we've got to be able to figure out how to do it, but I don't know how to do that.
It is all about the patient. Now, but the incentives have flipped upside down, and now there's a rush for financial incentives, and people are trying to take the path of least resistance to get the minimum data required to get their financial incentives. And then the clinicians are taking the 40% productivity hit because instead of taking the time to implement it the correct way, you have some people that are rushing it and just putting a bunch of check boxes or just a bunch. And CMS, you don't know how this is getting to you. You just know you're getting the data that you're asking for. You don't know if it was done correctly or incorrectly or even unethically. You're just getting the data that's required. And so that's where, you know, from an ED physician, you don't know if, and maybe you do, but maybe IT didn't put all the thought into develop this the correct way. Maybe the vendor does have all the flexibility to do it the correct way, but the CFO was putting so much pressure on IS to get their incentive check that they just slapped it out there to get it done. And they'll never, very unlikely to circle back around and do it right the second time. Mm-hmm. So that's the big conflict of interest right now, is you have this huge pressure from the financial point of view that was never there before. The CFO really never cared about this before, and all of a sudden they're saying, all right, I've been investing millions of dollars in IT over the last 10 years. You're telling me we have everything in place I need. How come we can't attest? And then all of a sudden you have hospitals slapping things together, productivity going down, and no one's looking at the clinical rationale for these measures. They're just trying to figure out, how do I get the data at a minimum to move forward with attestation? And most of the vendors, GE, everyone has the flexibility to do this right, the correct way. It's whether the hospital has the IT staff or the clinical staff to recommend how to do it.
Any comments on the web regarding this? We have some people on the web. No?
Yeah. From our phone folks, anybody on the phone have anything to say?
They're still at lunch.
I was going to say, they're still eating.
They took a long lunch.
So it sounds like we've really talked this particular question through pretty well, unless anybody has anything else to add. Do we want to go to the next slide? I think that's the same slide.
So that was the data. They've split up data and
workflow.
Oh,
okay. Oh, yeah. Data. These are good questions, actually. Sorry. I should have looked at my slides better last night. So this really gets into the whole data thing. We've touched on this a bit when we talked about the challenge of some of the terminologies and everything. But maybe we should focus a little bit more on some concrete recommendations around some of those challenges that we've discussed. Specifically, I've heard, you know, challenges with SNOMED, challenges with RxNorm, et cetera. So where are those challenges? What are the really top challenges, and what are then would be our recommendations to really try to mitigate those challenges?
I think one of the things that I think was mentioned by the Phelps people, that they shield their physicians from the code itself in some places where they can. And the mapping is done on the back end, which is allowed within the meaningful use framework. So I think one sort of solution, at least maybe even on an interim basis, is that there's the ability to do sort of, you know, back-end mapping or whatever, so that physicians are able to pick problems potentially within local term sort of ways, and code sets are in the background. Do you think that that's a good sort of way to bridge this gap until people really get used to doing codes directly?
Well, and I guess the question I would have is, should people ever get used to doing codes? If you think about SNOMED,
no.
I mean, I would say we should never expect a physician to pick SNOMED codes off a screen.
I was just going to say, show me a practicing physician who wants to choose SNOMED terms.
Yeah.
And there aren't any. But the problem comes in is mapping on the back end. You lose fidelity. Mm. And so I don't know exactly how to bridge that gap. It's part of the reason that I said earlier that it was a problem that the EH measures were all using SNOMED terminology. So we've had problems taking those SNOMED codes and mapping them back to ICD-9 and ICD-10. Right now there isn't a mapping, at least not by UMLS, for SNOMED to ICD-10. And so that's been doubly painful.
But I think... I know that this issue does come up, but maybe we should spend a couple of minutes in making a distinction between SNOMED and ICD. So SNOMED is more or less a nomenclature, which is the equivalent of a codified vocabulary, more so than anything else, so that you can speak within a certain terminology, whereas ICD is more a classification system. And so they're slightly different in terms of their usage. So the mapping that I was referring to was more local term to a coded term, not necessarily a sort of SNOMED to ICD-9, in other words, taking a vocabulary and mapping it into a classification system, which is a different issue somewhat, because... if you go from SNOMED to ICD, there is reasonable mapping going in that direction. You obviously can't come back because SNOMED is more granular, but then ICD is where all the administrative code sets reside for diagnoses, especially on the inpatient side, and that's not going away. That classification is necessary for resource consumption reasons and all of those, because SNOMED doesn't substitute for that. So we're going to have actually a very interesting dynamic that is going to play out, because the problem list that the clinicians maintain obviously is more or less a more clinical type of thing, and people are leaning more towards pushing SNOMED, whether they select from a SNOMED code or they select a local term that's mapped to some SNOMED codes, versus the problem list that is part of the classification system, which is the abstract that gets generated for administrative billing purposes, that's going to probably stay, I would imagine, for quite some time. So the question is, how do you reconcile those two? Because to me, it's really going to be a reconciliation issue at the end of the day, because you want, let's just say that the physicians are picking the problem list with SNOMED, which actually, by the way, the stage two, I don't know how many of you have read the NPRM, but the recommendation in stage two is to allow only SNOMED for problem list. That, I think, right now, by definition, right now, problem list can be either the one that the physicians typically choose within an EHR versus the one that the coders code, which is usually an ICD-9. So right now, by definition, according to meaningful use, both qualify as problem lists, so you fulfill the criterion. But going forward, it might be different. So I think if we have widespread adoption of the problem list, and let's say it is in SNOMED, then there's going to be a reconciliation issue that needs to make sure that the coders are actually doing something that's in sync with that. So there are lots of these sort of, you know, tricky challenges going forward with this.
And just to add to that, I think that some of the hospital measures are looking for specifically discharge diagnoses, which typically has been something that isn't really in the problem list. It's actually what the abstractors are specifically coding, because that's definitely related to billing. So how do we get around some of those challenges? What have you guys figured that out, or at Texas Health or at Phelps, as far as how to really think about that?
Well, this is Pam from Phelps County. We have not required our physicians to really be knowledgeable of the mapping, I mean, between problem list and diagnoses and what we're expected in reporting. And we do that, you know, through the coding still. So they document their problems, but I can't see that they'll ever be able to be savvy or to have the knowledge of all of those details, and I don't think that we should expect them to.
But how do you do that as far as if they're documenting their problems in their physician-friendly terminology, behind the scenes, are you using SNOMED? Are you using ICD-9?
Well, yeah,
do you have
it is
your
ICD-9.
Medical records folks do separate chart abstraction? Just kind of thinking about the whole process.
No, it is ICD-9, and then we map that to SNOMED codes in our reporting product. But, yeah, so the physicians aren't really responsible for that.
Right. And do those ICD-9 codes, are those used in the chart abstraction process, or do they get re-evaluated?
You mean by coders or by encoding? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by
encoding. It's through the coding process.
We're pretty similar to them. The physician does use the ICD-9 codes, and then the coders go in and they look at what the physician has documented, but then they put in the more specific code. So it's, you know what, that's such a I don't have a plan right now. That's a long process, I think.
In our application right now for inpatient, we're looking at coded diagnoses because basically that historically that's how the reporting has what it was geared towards. But we have been wondering whether we should be switching to using the problem list entered by the clinician based on their own terms mapped behind the scenes. I'm really curious as well.
So is it then our recommendation that both SNOMED and ICD be supported in documentation for quality measures, or no?
I think so.
Yeah? I mean, based on what you guys are saying, it would be very important for you to have, because the specification, I know that the 1.2 actually has gone on the diagnosis to from SNOMED to ICD-9, which is sort of the way the Joint Commission original specs were. For at least case selection, they are using the ICD-9 coded diagnoses.
This is Hannah. I have a question. When we're looking at the requirements, what's the motivation to only use SNOMED? I mean, what does it accomplish if they take the ICD-9 option away?
My understanding is this is, and again, you know, there's a lot of discussion and chatter about this topic, but my understanding is that the problem list that the physicians are generating are more similar to a physician codified vocabulary in a sense. And that needs to be so rich that it can capture all the nuances of what they are talking about. And ICD, being a classification system, is not granular enough to do that. That's really the prime reason why people go in that direction when they talk about documentation by clinicians. Because typically, with SNOMED, you have so many concepts that there is literally nothing that you can actually say in a colloquial term that cannot be mapped to a concept, which is codified. Whereas ICD-9, you are several, at least a couple of steps above that, and you cannot granularly capture what they're talking about clinically. So the trick in all of this is that you've got the doctors talking clinical terms, and that needs to then convert into some kind of an abstract or some classification system that then feeds into the reporting mechanism. So I think that sort of, but they both need to be in sync so that there is one concern that when coders are solely responsible for coding, they're not capturing the essence of the visit. So if perhaps the physicians are capturing the essence of the visit either in their own terms but mapped to some codified concepts or selecting from those codified concepts, and they then map back to a slightly higher level that feeds into the billing issues and the resource consumption issues and then feeds into the quality reporting, perhaps that's the workflow that needs to be developed in future as we go forward. So I think that's kind of the best answer I can give on this complicated topic.
it is complicated, but you know, as we can make recommendations for today, I think what we're hearing is that we think it's best to continue to use both. So there's
or allow the flexibility as long as the specifications support those.
What about other coding issues or things that you've seen? And we talked a little bit about RxNorm. I think that the challenge with RxNorm is that obviously we know that, I forget the number of new medications that are approved every month. It's a pretty high number, but I won't quote it. So we know that there's constantly new codes coming in. So that challenge kind of comes back to what we talked about, is how often do we have to update these specifications to accommodate the new codes that we know about? And we were talking with Debbie about, is a year frequent enough? Does it need to be more like 6 months so that physicians don't get frustrated because they can't document what they're actually administering to the patient or ordering for the patient?
I want, is that a realistic, is that something, if we did want to do that, is it even a realistic request for CMS to send those, to update the specifications that often? I know it's updated quite frequently, but every 6 months.
I think that certainly please comment in the NPRM mm-hmm. about this topic, and we, you know, welcome your comments. And want you to realistically think about it. One of the timelines we're talking about is, you know, we looked at other specifications that are released, and I know manual specifications maybe twice a year, but considering the amount of programming and resources involved to update specs, we were talking about annual release of specifications, and then subsequent release throughout the year, probably not more than like once, or if there's an emergency withdrawal of a medication or addition of a recommended medication, something very limited to update that specification. But the major specification updates annually with additional individual codes or minimal updates every 6 months or as needed. So I just wanted to comment on that.
I have one comment that when you guys update the manual, the specification manuals, the way I see it working is you update the manuals and then our vendor will update their reporting system, and that may take another 6 months, even up to a year I've seen it take before those changes actually hit our system to where we can map those into our reporting. And so the sooner we can get changes from you guys means the sooner we can get changes from our vendor. And sometimes we are at the mercy of our vendor to give us those new reporting tools without getting too into our system, but they give us special updates that allow us to map those elements in. And a lot of times we have to go without until the spec manual comes out, and then they start working on it from there. So
that's a challenge, I think. You want to have real-time data, real-time reporting, be able to use that, and as close to when the specifications came out. I'm really not involved in the manual specifications release. I just hear about that process. But I think certainly we're in a whole new area, a whole new timeline, and we're going to have to catch up. So by the time we're issuing updates to specifications in 2015, the amount of programming and required for that will be much less than now with all these new measures that you may want to capture when, depending on the requirements. So, you know, it's painful growing, and, you know, I love that Kubler-Ross edited slide. I think that can apply to many areas that we're discussing today, but I think the updates will certainly be less. And then as new measures are developed, that's, you know, an important point. Measure developers and measure stewards that are looking at de novo measures are going to really go through that whole conversation about, is it feasible to capture this from an EHR? And by then, you all will be such experts, you'll be able to handle just about anything. But you know, the retooled measures versus the new measures, I think we're going to see a big difference in what we're going to require to capture and what could be beneficial and things like that. So
yeah, that's a good point. And I was hoping that our friends in the technology breakout are dealing with some of these challenges, too, and thinking about some of the tools that today aren't working quite as well as we'd like them to with the HQMF and the quality data model, et cetera, but how we can get those to the point where it does make it a lot easier. I kind of think back, and this shows my age, but I'm thinking back to when we first started using e-prescribing, and we all had to get updates to medications frequently, and it was definitely a challenge at first because we weren't used to being able to update kind of real time on the fly, and now we don't really think about that anymore. It happens, and we update our drug databases, and everybody's happy, and it's not a huge effort. So I'm hopeful, like Deborah said, that we'll get to that point, and we're moving towards that direction. So
I think the last bullet there, we heard earlier comments that it is certainly doable to capture some data elements in a structured fashion. Is that fair to say? That you get some pushback, but not as much as if you say you've got to do everything structured, right? So I suppose that some unstructured data is going to live for a while. And in addition to the technology track, we have an innovation track, and I think I heard that was one of the examples that Floyd was using, that perhaps they could find some innovative ways to take the unstructured data and convert it into some sort of structured text. So there may be some innovative technological solution in future that might get at that issue. I mean, there are people who are trying that now. It's almost like voice recognition. It's always like 98% there, but it needs to get to 99%.
So my personal feeling is that it has to go in the other direction. Instead of trying to take unstructured data and make structured data out of it, what we need to do is to make the gathering of information in a structured manner easy and fast enough for clinicians to want to use it. And then we'll have the data that
would
we
you,
need.
Would you accept the compromise that perhaps the majority of it is structured, but that perhaps some of it could live unstructured, or would you insist on everything being structured?
No. I think that you're absolutely right, that some of the information will always end up being unstructured. Right. But the challenge for us vendors is to try to make tools
such that clinicians want to use them. And we've been working really hard with some of our clients to develop better documentation tools for physicians that they actually want to use. Not there yet, but you know, that's my belief, that in order to get structured data, we have to do it that way.
So we would recommend that this be hopefully a fast incremental process, that people shouldn't just recoil from it, that none of this can be captured structured, that there is a good chance that a good portion of it could be captured, but in the right places, right?
Well, I think everything should end up being structured, but realistically, not everything can be right now, but there's always room for improvement. We should say that our goal should be to have everything structured, but I think that's going to take some time.
Okay.
I agree.
Yeah.
Great.
So
I'd love to hear yours.
Yeah. I think as somebody who does both software and the physician side, I think there are ways to make it usable. And I think that even though we had a lot of limitations, we worked with what our vendor gave us, and we actually have, believe it or not, I created 75 order sets. And everybody loves the order sets, and everybody loves the preference list. There's a lot that I think we should be doing with the software that we're not. If I put in a chief complaint of ankle pain, I should not have to put in a code for every x-ray I order for that ankle pain.
Yeah.
I've already put the chief complaint in.
Right.
We know they have ankle pain. If I need, because ortho needs, you know, three different x-rays, I have to go in every time and change that. That's crazy. And these are the things we need to change. If I have a chief complaint of chest pain, and I order an EKG, I shouldn't have to put in that the patient has chest pain. That's just crazy to me, because we've already said it. If I have said that the patient isn't pregnant, or I have a negative urine pregnancy test on the chart, I should not have to answer that question for an ankle x-ray, in particular for an ankle x-ray. Now, belly x-ray may be a little different, but for an ankle x-ray, no way. Should not have to answer it. You know, just there's a lot of things that we could be doing with the software that we're not, and we're making it harder on the physicians, and we're increasing their mental load so that they're not spending their mental energy on taking care of the patient, but instead they're spending their mental energy on getting this system to work correctly, learning why they have to do things in a certain way in order to literally keep the hospital alive. And I think that's where we need to, you know, I'm bifurcated when I'm in the department right now, because, and in fact, I'm worried about my clinical skills, because everybody's going, how do I do this? How do I do that? How do I do this? And I'm not spending as much time on the patient care.
Yeah.
And that's we need to concentrate on getting away from that. We need to concentrate on making the system work for us instead of us working for the system.
I think that does bring up another important point, which I think may have been alluded to a little bit in Pam's presentation, and that is to try to make a distinction. And it sort of it goes to whether the vendor does it or whether you sort of adapt your workflow. The important point of distinguishing between data elements that are applicable to the entire visit, no matter how many measures come off of that visit. So you document it once, as in your example. Once you have documented, you know, ankle pain, you don't have to do it for all your different steps in between, whether it's ordering or something. The same thing applies really for documentation over on the quality measurement side. In your example that, you know, clinical trials, it's applicable to the entire visit. So you shouldn't have to ask that repeatedly in every measure, which typically sometimes gets done on the abstraction world side. So, you know, if you separate out the elements of whether they are applicable to the entire visit versus to specific tasks, and then you can ask those, you know, so then you can become parsimonious in that, so that you're asking only those things that once for and apply to every measure that is pertaining to that visit. So I think that's another sort of key way to try to design the data capture
and the data model
and avoid the duplication that you referred to.
Well, and I think, too, it would really help with usability, user buy-in. It helps with your build, because, for instance, when we first came live, every ICD-9 code out there was available for every X-ray. Well, you know, you don't. If you just put in pain, you don't get paid for any of them. So that's really not helpful. You know, that really doesn't help us. And so then you have 6 ankle pains. Well, which one is the right one to put in?
Yeah.
You know, and so if you have it automatically pulling stuff in for you that is applicable and you know you have that in your chart, then you don't have to go through the list and make the list applicable to every order you put in. So it saves time, money, effort right from the very beginning if you do that.
The ED actually is an interesting difference in terms of documentation in general, that you guys tend to be more structured in most of your documentation, more so than the other sort of inpatient areas.
Yeah, and I think that's very true. I've learned a whole heck of a lot about compliance and coding and billing and all kinds of other things during this process that I had no idea about before this. But I think even though we are more structured, I think sometimes it's harder for us to get that down, because I will often have 3 or 4 resus patients going at the same time, and I'm standing at the end of 4 beds resuscitating 4 patients. And how in the world are you ever going to document that?
Right.
You know? Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And but then what do you remember?
I know.
Then what do you remember? I mean, so it really doesn't, you know, we have to find a way to make it work. We actually haven't been able to go live in resus because we're too busy, and we can't even get the patient registered so that we can use them in 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah, that's a real challenging area, absolutely.
So we come to the fun part now. Now is the time to make your wish list for the future.
Yep. Where do we want to go?
For me, I think what I'm hearing is when we talked about bright lights around the table, we have so many nurse informaticians, physicians with an informatics background. I have to think there's so many facilities out there that don't have this.
Mm.
And how do they learn? And how do they do this? This is a whole staffing piece. This is a whole integral piece that is not cost effective. It's not clinically, you know, tied to a service, but it's the service that greases the skids for everybody else. But you take a nurse out of nursing, out of clinical, you build a whole different department, and this is sort of like the billing department used to just send little bills out. And then that increased 40%. And now you have the IT department, which is, you know, 3 little retired people who love to play video games that are now out there building systems and trying to find the framework and the infrastructure and figure out what needs to connect to what. So this is a huge piece of education in our communities, in addition to us as hiring and education to our infrastructure to see a value here.
Yes, so I think that that is really at the heart of what this whole eMeasures Learning Collaborative is about, to hopefully take all of this information from folks who really have been the leaders in this area or the bright lights, and synthesize it in a way that those who don't have those resources can benefit from it. Obviously, we can't do their work for them, but we can certainly provide them with the guidance that is the collective wisdom of this group. And that's really what's at the heart of this whole effort. And how we do it going forward, I think, is going to be discussed later on in the combined session. But we certainly hope that this is a living, breathing organization that can actually impart that knowledge and be the bridge between, you know, taking that knowledge, synthesizing it, converting it into usable information. Right, Debbie, you want to say anything?
And on the physician side, you know, there's government-funded regional extension centers, and these RECs are reaching out to individual physician practices throughout the country. They're being set up in all the states, or they are set up in many, more than one in a state, and to provide that education and outreach. And I just know a little bit about them, but, you know, I think that's a really important point. How do we help everybody in the industry so that when someone is in a small rural a hospital that has not implemented anything, that they can still send that important patient data interoperably and to you all or whoever has implemented it. So, you know, at the crux of the issue, the patient, and there's clear communication and understanding of their condition and what they've been through. So, you know, that's a great point.
Sure. I think the RACs in general are right now so focused on just getting systems in place and helping people guide, making selections and so forth, that at least as of now, based on my couple of experiences, they have not yet tackled the quality side of things. They have a box as a placeholder, but perhaps, you know, we could provide them with the material as it pertains to quality reporting and use them as a platform to disseminate that information. So that would be a good way to sort of, you know, put this information out there.
Yep.
Because they just, I think, are not obviously into the quality reporting itself, but they clearly are very focused on trying to get people connected, implement software, helping them select software and get adoption as much as possible. And I'm sure that they would be going towards the quality side of things once they have things in place. But for us, it might be a good way to partner with some of them as the quality measure, e-measure content or whatever education material is generated is then distributed out into the field.
Okay, so if we're kind of looking at our next charge, as he said, we kind of think about what we really want for the future, what's our wish list. And we've talked about some of this already. So we talked about recommendations for future use, and standards and things like that. We talked about the fact that we all think that we need to allow sufficient time in order to develop the right quality measures, to implement them correctly on a vendor site, to have the time on the provider site to really think about the workflow issues and address them before you have to actually start collecting the data. We also talked a lot about the concept of, instead of trying to retool measures, coming up with these de novo measures that are really meant to be used for collection of data in an EHR. What else have we talked about, or should we talk about, as far as our recommendations? Do we have some up there?
Yeah, we have some. I guess we talked about the collaboration. And so we talked about some of the documentation, that there are multiple choices, and that perhaps in the near term we have to find we have to constrain that choice in some way, not make it totally free for all. So that was one issue. Organizational issues, I guess, we talked about, you know, structure and resources. We've already communicated communication between vendor and staff. I think that's probably not fitting into the future request. But these are sort of
some of the things,
points that came up. I think one of the things that was pointed out was that it doesn't matter which size organization you have; it needs to be a multi-stakeholder effort, and all the stakeholders need to be at the table from the beginning. So that's an important point in terms of organizational structure that we wanted to communicate, that this is truly a multi-stakeholder effort. We talked about a little bit about advanced technology, that, you know, given that maybe hopefully a smaller and smaller percentage of the data would still be unstructured, that if in the short term there is some technological solution that's possible, that may be at least used as a bridging solution, maybe until we get to the point where most of it is structured data capture.
Dr. Butt, this is Pam from Phelps. On that point, just that we are careful to point out that the documentation quality doesn't decrease. I love structured data because I do a lot with reporting. But I do see that as we have structured templates, sometimes the quality of the story isn't told. You know, so the narrative note sometimes tells more of the story of the patient than structured data. So I'm not sure how we marry that, but that we're careful not to lose that story of what's happening with the patient.
That's actually a very good point. That,
yep.
In our zeal to try to get everything structured, mm-hmm. we don't want to lose the narrative and the fidelity
really good
of that
point.
Information. Yep. It's always very easy to say deny is all. So I've seen those review of systems that denies vaginal bleeding, vaginal discharge for a male patient, and that sort of stuff gets in there, I know. So, yeah, well, that's a good point. Yeah, it does deny. Okay, so we spent actually a fair amount of time earlier in trying to sort of focus on the clinical practice guidelines, clinical decision
right.
support.
And we did think about our best practices and that kind
and
of thing.
Various touch points, important touch points where CDS at the point of care ultimately will be how this exclusion stuff is going to be captured with some degree of, I wouldn't say ease, but at least completeness.
So that brings up a good point. Would one of our recommendations be for more advanced clinical decision support and really thinking about how we can truly
right.
use that in the right way?
Right.
I see Kendra grimacing.
I really just think we're not far enough along in CDS to recommend that at this point.
Well, and I know we're not to recommend it, but we're talking about future. So for the future, what's our aspiration? And I'm used to a lot about allowing the system to kind of be smart and intelligent about the way that it's collecting data and then displaying it back to the clinician versus having to make so many decisions yourself, right? That's really what we're thinking about in the future.
Right.
I agree.
Right. No,
I agree. You don't want a gazillion alerts coming
yeah,
up
yeah.
and saying,
sure.
yeah,
sure.
Right. No, absolutely agree. Is there anything else as we think outside the box that we think we should put on there or that we haven't talked about? Or are we ready to kind of move on to our summary? Oh, field testing, absolutely. That's a really good point.
I know some of, you know, our members really, you know, they struggled in stage one. There have been problems with the specifications, and what would really be helpful to them is to have, before a measure is approved for a program, to really have it field tested
yes.
among a number of vendors
yes.
so that
yes.
you can have some of those kinks identified and figured out. And that, to me, would be one of the first steps.
I think that's absolutely the one of the best recommendations that I've heard today. There's been a lot of good recommendations, but I think we would all probably agree that that would be fabulous. If we could have, and that goes back to having the time to be able to do this in a really thoughtful way versus kind of rushed as I think we all felt. I mean, everybody around this table was rushed for stage one, and we're feeling a little rushed for stage two, but let's hope that we're moving towards a time, you know, and I think everybody has learned a lot from some of the challenges.
Sure.
Hi.
And we are doing more testing of the measures that are being proposed. Again, you know, the timeline constraints are one thing, but NQF has proposed testing guidelines for electronically reported measures, EHR, that come from an EHR, so the electronic specifications. So they proposed testing guidelines, and there are testing guidelines for retooled measures, and there's separate testing guidelines for de novo measures. And so right now with the measures that we're retooling, there is a level of testing being done. And as we have more time before implementation of future rules, there will be more testing that will be done, and then more intense testing for de novo measures. So right now, we're retooled measures are going, their data elements are being mapped to the QDM, and they are being entered into the measure authoring tool, and we're doing feasibility testing. And then as we have de novo measures, they will also go through the reliability and validity testing, and then you will get that comparison field testing for electronically reported measures versus measures that we can go into the electronic health record, similar to what you all did in Texas, and look at the data elements and look at the, you know, is this the right data that's being reported on for that measure? So we are incorporating that into our work in, with the clinical quality measures. And, you know, we certainly heard you loud and clear in stage one and felt the same way before that. But I welcome that recommendation.
Right. Okay, so I think we're at the point where we need to think about our summary for that will be used in the discussion later this afternoon. So best practices. I know that one of the things I heard loud and clear from our two sites, as well as everybody else, is the agreement that there needs to be a collaborative team made up of multi-stakeholders, and especially with a strong physician lead. Is that one of our best practices? We can make that too. I don't know. But I think the strong physician leadership is definitely key. Now, hey, we should change that. Leading practice. Absolutely. That's one of our...
Well, maybe that would be a recommendation.
That's...
I suppose maybe we could put it as number three. Maybe consider...
I think that's
using
fabulous.
Leading practices.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so under best practice, I think we also talked about the importance of having time for education and making sure that that happens. For
I think the evidence base, we should probably just... Is this a versus on in this one, or?
Well, I think evidence-based can hit gaps.
Right.
Because we talked about evidence-based and leading practice
clinical
and the
practice
gap
guidelines and
between those, right?
And tied to clinical decision support. Right.
So that may be a better place for that is up in gaps.
Or timeliness of the evidence. Is that what we were alluding to in terms of a gap?
Well, the time lag between once evidence gets
published
and you're already on to your next leading practice.
Yeah.
Right.
Right, absolutely. I think another gap that we heard was the fact that we don't have a good way today to capture data out of unstructured text. Right. But how well does it work today? So we really need to think about how we can move that forward.
Right.
And utilize.
Yeah, pulling. I would say it's more capturing. Well, I would say that
using ability to use unstructured data for quality reporting, right? Right. Or the use of unstructured data for e-measures, quality reporting. There's a gap in our inability to use data that's captured in an unstructured format for quality reporting, right? Yeah, it's captured, but it's captured in an unstructured format, and we can't use it for an e-measure because there's no human to convert it into something else. No, I think it's. I probably would say that inability to use
unstructured data. Yeah.
For quality, for e-measures reporting.
Yeah, that would be the gap.
And part of that is that there's
too much of
the data that's currently being captured in normal workflows.
Okay, so that would be one other thing, that there are barriers or there are gaps in capturing structured data. So that would be one gap. And then the other is that a lot of it is unstructured, and we have inability to use that data for e-measures.
So that's a new gap, right?
Yes. So inability actually to use unstructured data. For e-measures reporting. For e-measures reporting. Right. And then there's lack of structured data, or not enough structured data.
The gap is really not the amount of structured data, it's the practice pattern.
Yeah.
Is that our practice pattern is use of unstructured data.
Uh-huh. But
so
not
there's always a way to capture it. You can capture it.
Right.
But does
it
really fit into a workflow?
Right.
And a lot of times if it doesn't, then we don't make the position document. And it's there. You can make anything structured, but it doesn't really work.
So it sounds like there's a gap somewhere around there.
Difficulty in capturing.
Ability to address workflow or how would we phrase that? How do we want to phrase that?
Maybe capturing structured data as part of a clinician-accepted workflow.
What does everybody think? Is that what we're trying to get to?
But I think that we sort of addressed that. But I think the other point was that there's a gap in not having enough structured data captured as part of the existing workflow.
Is it lack of adoption?
Or difficulty in?
Yeah. It is. There is a culture piece to
difficulty
this.
Difficulty in capturing.
It's not just cultural, it's also technological,
yes.
Right? So
yeah.
If we had the tools
to make it
easier for providers to capture data in a structured way, I'm sure they would do it.
I'm kind of thinking about that whole hard coding of quality measure data issue that we talked about, and the fact that even though I was capturing it over in this part of the system, the reporting expected me to be capturing it in this other part. So is that inflexibility? Is that
how about say that it's difficulty in capturing enough structured data?
Well, and I think that the difficulty is, for instance, let's talk about dictation. That's a large unstructured data set. The workflow of that is much easier, much more efficient than documenting it in a structured format. So I don't know if it's
You know, I hear us saying
that. It's a structured workflow.
I hear us saying that, but we've been working with one of our clients on a structured method of doing noting. And they have mandated it throughout their hospitals, and they're actually saying that their physician acceptance is very high, and that they're saying that they can do their documentation just as fast, if not faster, once they get used to the tool. So I do not believe that the technology isn't there. I think it's getting there. It has a ways to go. But I think if we're talking about, you know, visions for the future, we really do need to consider that. I think it's possible.
I think there's different pieces to it. So she's right. It's a culture piece to that, but it's also on the IT side creating a note template that's actually usable. Or, you know, so there's a configuration piece, there's a culture piece, and then there's a, you know, fitting that into a workflow.
Right. So I think those are not inconsistent. So what we're saying is that that's a current gap, and we would recommend that both technological and cultural solutions be found to incorporate more, to capture more structured data. Right? That would be a recommendation to encourage both technological and cultural, because those are the two sort of barriers that we identified in adopting capture of more structured data. Promote the capture of more structured data by addressing cultural and technological issues. How about that? Ginny is not convinced.
I think it's the right thing. I'm just not sure
how to word it.
We're saying it the right
yeah.
way. I know exactly what we're saying.
This is Amy Crow with Texas Health Resources. One of the things that I've heard that some of the physicians who've been practicing maybe longer than others is that they don't have confidence in their ability to do the typing, so it's much easier for them to dictate. That said, there are those tools where if they learn to build those templates that have the things that they typically will use for one diagnosis or another, they can document more quickly by the fact that they build it once and then they can utilize it over and over and over again. So I think the other piece of it is that it's change.
Yeah, that's
and it's just a matter, it's just a matter that we all resist sometimes change, perhaps.
The problem you get into with that, and we actually had a huge problem with this because we wanted to do something similar, is compliance. And so the lines of compliance are very, very delicate. And so if you create something that is considered a macro that would have you document possibly the incorrect thing, compliance is going to jump all over you. So while that seems like a very feasible and great solution, if you are found to be non-compliant, that physician is out of luck for 3 to 6 months. So we really can't. I mean,
so it has to do with that legal documentation.
Exactly.
The outcome.
Right. Exactly. So to create something that is macro based or kind of standardized based on, all right, I see this chest pain patient. They have chest pain. I describe their chest pain. I have a normal exam. You can't have a thing called a normal male exam. That's non-compliant.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, because, you know, in there you may have genitourinary and you didn't do a genitourinary exam. So that it's becoming, and it's becoming a bigger issue with compliance. So while I think that's a great solution for a lot of people, and I have, we literally, our group, there's 30 of us, and we range from right out of residency all the way up to 67. And literally it's a line like this. And these guys hate the system. And these guys love the system. And these people in here, some like, some don't like, whatever. But these guys can't use it because they're going like this, typing with their one finger. And they can't get through it. So, and they were actually, in the past, where I took a 40% hit, I worked with computers for 10 years. I can type and talk to you at the same time. So that's easy for me. But for them, they took the 40% productivity hit plus the typing hit. And they were some of our most productive, because they've been in the business so long, they were some of our most productive physicians. So I think it is a big issue, and I think there needs to be a solution found. You run up against so many walls when you try to look for those solutions, and in this case, it would be a compliance issue.
Well, there's always going to be the super-duper users and the not-so-good users. And so you have to, or you can, come up with solutions for the super-duper good user, and then others for the, you know, IT can make a template for a physician that's compliance approved. And, you know, I think what it boils down to, with approval from compliance.
Well, and I think that works great in a community hospital. You know, they didn't dock my hours when I started doing this. I'm sitting here talking to my build team. And I go back and I work my clinical hours just like I normally would. So that's great for a community or a hospital that is not, you know. But when you really look at it, who's getting, with all the insurance issues, who's the one who's getting overcrowded right now most of the time? It's the academic facilities. And so we don't have IT support like that because we don't have those resources. We didn't even start building up until a good 6 months into the implementation. Because nobody had any idea. We thought that the vendor was going to take care of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, not so much.
Yep. I think we have.
This is good. We're starting to run out of time, and I have one other thought, though, that I remember us talking about, and everybody kind of jumped on it when I said it, or I think somebody else actually said it first, was usability testing under recommendations in order to ensure that we're accommodating workflow and quality and patient safety aspects.
And not that I think it should go on this slide, but I think a great place to do that, and the thing I've been using the most, is a simulation. So I take all my guys to the simulation center, and we fail or we succeed, one or the other.
Any last-minute recommendations?
Do we want to put anything on here about the SNOMED and ICD-9 recommendation? Do we want to put that under there
to support ICD-9 and
both of those?
I think from a clinical documentation standpoint.
I think under recommendation.
Can we just say a general? All the guidelines shouldn't be different from each other. So, you know, our consistency between the guidelines. So. Our MU measures don't require SNOMED and our CMS, you know, that kind of thing.
So code sets need to be consistent across the measure specifications, the standards, and certification. Debbie?
How would you answer the question that different code sets are more appropriate for different clinical quality measures versus the structural objective, meaningful use.
Well, to the point that's possible, there's so many different groups out there who are wanting you to report the information, and the information is subtly different, but just enough to where you're having to create a brand new
code.
Yeah, and it's really hard, and I think they're trying to get at the same information. Mm-hmm. So, and I know we touched on that this morning before our meeting about kind of standardizing where we can, or talking to each other at least about, you know, making it a little bit easier to report things by coming to a consensus
mm-hmm.
at some level. I know we,
mm-hmm.
but not that it's possible for all things
mm-hmm.
by any means.
Are we getting kicked out?
Well, we are.
Do we need to do a quick review?
But we also get a break tonight. So thank you, everybody.
All right, everybody, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great session.
Thank you.